The following presentation was recorded live, February 14th through the 17th, at the McHenry Convention Center in San Jose, California, for RSA Conference 2006. We take you live, where our session is just getting underway.
Good morning. Welcome to The Sky Isn't Falling, Legal Effects of the Failure of the Hash Algorithm. Just a couple of notes before we start. I'm sure you're all tired of hearing this, but I'll remind everybody to please turn off your cell phone and any PDAs. Also, we do have evaluation forms in the back. If you'd be so kind to fill one out and just drop it in the box, we appreciate your feedback. Also, for any attorneys in the room, please note the following. If you're interested in CLE credit, the back of the room on the left-hand side of the table, there are forms that have to be completed for CLE credit. All attorneys seeking CLE credit must sign in the pink sheet. There's also a blue certificate of attendance to take with you, and if you need instructions, there's instructions in the back on the white sheet. We've been told that the ABA will mail a certificate of attendance to each attendee who signs in on the pink sheet. I'd like to introduce our speakers for today. The first is Hoyt L. Kesterson II. Hoyt is a consultant in Phoenix, Arizona, and specializes in securing electronic commerce and distributed systems. He has chaired the international committee responsible for defining X.500, including X.509, since 1986. He's participated in the American Bar Association's work on legal aspects of digital signatures in electronic commerce since its beginning. Our second speaker is Stephen Tepler, CEO, Time Certain, LLC. Mr. Tepler is an attorney, inventor, and CEO of Time Certain, which he founded after having confronted firsthand the evidentiary issues presented by challenge-prone digital data content. He is a co-author of ANSI X9F4, Trusted Timestamp Standard for the Financial Industry, a co-founder of Information Assurance Consortium, and is also a litigator admitted to practice in New York, D.C., and Florida. Please welcome today's speakers.
Hi, everybody. This talk was actually generated because last year someone asked a question. Last year, Stephen and I were in a session with some other people, and the question came up, the very first question came up, can you talk about this announced hash problem, which of course had nothing to do with our talk, which of course would have been somewhat technical in nature, and we didn't have any time, so I said, well, that's out of scope, let's move on. But we thought, well, maybe you'd be interested in this. And if those are on the ABA ISC list, you may recall that sometime 9 months ago or something like that, I posted some comments on that, but I did know that not everybody understood what was going on here, and that's pretty good because I'm not a cryptographer and I don't understand what's going on. And in fact, amazingly enough, this lady from China who does this stuff, you might be interested to know, does it without a computer. She actually just does it sitting at a table. She breaks this hash function, so it's nothing like any kind of computer process. Someone actually has some sort of assignment. Someone visited her and then they assigned a graduate student try to actually build a machine that emulates her thought process. So I guess she's some sort of a hash savant, I don't know. Anyway, so what we're going to do here, first I have to, just because not everyone may have the same background, I have to just give you just a little bit of stuff about what's really happening when you sign a message. When you sign a message, you have a message, and we never really do the encryption option against the message because the idea, of course, is not to encrypt the message so it can't be read. The idea is to actually show source or data origin and to make sure that we provide some secure integrity for the message. And so when we do this, interestingly enough, it does bounce, yes. We do a hash function, which produces, some people don't like to see message digests. I like to see it because when the first RSA technology does, this is the term they did. Some people actually write the word hash, okay, so it produces a hash. Hash function and message digest are the same. Incidentally, message digest is the MD and MD5. So, what is a hash function? Because I actually have always thought hash functions are kind of really more fascinating than cryptography. The inputs reduce typically to a fixed size, okay? And not only that, you really can't predict it. So I can take the entire Encyclopedia Britannica and I can run it through a hash function. And when I'm done, I have 160, okay? Now, the interesting thing is I can go to the Encyclopedia Britannica, close my eyes, pick a volume, pick a page, pick a word, change that word, and run this hash function. And the hash will change, and it will change significantly, and it will be unpredictable. It's really amazing, okay? So the interesting thing, of course, is that message cannot be derived from the hash, which kind of really makes sense because it'd be an interesting compression technique to re-derive an Encyclopedia Britannica out of 160. Now, mathematicians, man, they're cagier than lawyers. They, in terms of pinning them down. So they will never say it's impossible to do something. Mathematicians will say it's computationally infeasible. Okay? So it is computationally infeasible to construct two messages to produce the same digest, and it's computationally infeasible to construct a message to produce a given digest. Now, this is where the technical confusion happens, because most of you look at this and say, gee, that sounds like the same thing. But it's not. And the fact that it's not is really important for you to understand what has happened to the hash function. The first one says is that if I'm sitting there, I can actually construct two messages. I can kind of work on both messages at the same time. You know, shave a little here, add a little here, this or that, you know, and work them down to where they will both produce the same hash function. That's called a collision, okay? Kind of like a birthday or whatever else. And a good hash function doesn't even accidentally do collisions. You don't want to, you know, you don't want to have the Encyclopedia Britannica and Compton's both come down to the same hash function, for example. The second one really says that, gee, if I see a hash function, so for instance, let's just suppose that Stephen Wu is a lawyer out there who's actually got a contract out there and it's been digitally signed and so there's a hash function. If I see that hash function, can I sit there and construct another message that would come to that same hash function? That is fundamentally different. That's two different aspects of what hash functions are. Okay? So you have to understand that. The whole idea, of course, we encrypt the message to do that. SHA is the one we talk about. There are variants called SHA-224, which I think is an interesting number, 256, 384, and SHA-512. Those weird numbers have to do with the fact that 32 and 64-bit machines can really do interesting quick processing. So again, back to where I was, I take that message digest, I take my private key, I go into a signing function, the result is a digital signature. So what is a digital signature? A digital signature is the encryption of a message digest, okay, with the private key of a key pair, right? And that gives me a digital signature, and then that gives me a digitally signed message. So that's what's going on. Okay, so hash and key. So look at that, you know. Basically, if you think about it, I really need both of these at the same time. I need a hash, I need a key, and whichever one is weakest is the one that's going to break. So, you know, if I have a fence and it's locked with a chain and there's a lock on it, you know, a key like that, and I start pulling on it, the lock will break or the chain will break, whichever is weakest, but no matter what, the gate's open. Right? So that's really the effect. I hate when that happens. Going backwards. Okay, so the weaker the two. And there's a really interesting book that can be slightly misread, is that you actually, if you have AES 256, you know, you should be doing SHA-512 or something. But no, it's just basically saying those are comparable work factors, and so whatever your strength is, you should pick the right numbers in this range. Now, when I do the verification, same thing, message digest, public key, verifying function, valid or invalid. So the problem is going to be is that I can break it, the digital signature, in one of two ways. You know, I can mess around with the hash, or I can mess around with the encryption of it. So if you look at all the articles and stuff like that, you'll see that the community pondered the robustness of the encryption algorithm and the fundamental problem which was base. So for instance, like for RSA, it's a large factoring large numbers, right? And the concern was, well, gee, will there be some sort of mathematical advance that makes factoring easier, in which case that'll break it. So a lot of discussion about that over the years. More recently, the community has been wondering about the robustness of platforms carrying out the encryption. Okay, I have nice digital signature, but it's running on Windows. Perhaps there's a problem here. We had a lot of discussion on that. But we didn't discuss the hash function very much at all. And then, last year at the RSA conference, for those who were here, the cryptographer's panel, a bomb was dropped. This guy had received a message from this woman in China. I will not even try to pronounce her first name. And the Wang is really a Wang, okay? And she announced a successful collision attack both against MD5 and SHA-1. Really quick against MD5. Okay. Note the operative word collision. Okay. Of the two characteristics of the factions, that's where her attacks were done. This is an attack against one aspect. In other words, one can, with a great deal of computation, create two documents that compute to the same hash value. Okay. One cannot create a document that will hash to a given value. What does that mean? Well, Russ Housley, when he posted, he said, well, of course, naturally, documents that are already signed aren't under any attack. That was a very pithy statement. Many people looked at it and said, well, what does that mean? Well, what he meant was, is something's already been signed, someone's going to be looking at a hash, it's already there, and the problem is, can you construct another message that will go to the same hash? Okay, that's not what collision is. Collision is producing two at the same time. So examination of this attack gives two hopes. Number one, it requires a lot of work on the first block of data. And a block and a hash function really isn't necessarily, can't be really inferred from like the number 256 or 512 or something. But there are blocks that they do. So in fact, if you could actually increase that block, the amount of work needed grows significantly. So interestingly enough, there's an algorithm called SHA-256 has that bigger block. And we believe if you go to that, okay, then in fact, you've negated this attack. Unless, of course, this lady is more savant than we recognize at the moment. Now, the interesting thing is when NIST put out all its algorithms, it said SHA-1 was 2010. That's its lifetime. Think about it. We're actually fairly close to that, right? So we're just kind of having to move that up, okay? And again, the second point is that the attack gives no ability to find a message that will compute to a given attack. This means that you don't worry about those things that are already signed, okay? You don't worry about those things whose contacts come from multiple sources because people are putting things together and therefore you don't have complete control of the document to make the changes you need to get the hash functions, okay? Finding useful variants of simple text files is difficult because you're changing bits. And so even if I had a message that said, I owe you $400, and I tried to find something that would come to the same hash as that message, it's liable to say Zixelkrook. And so even though you've done a nice little attack, it's an attack of no value, right? But the problem is that the attacker may in fact be able to do something if he has total control of both of the documents or if he's able to predict. So even if you're going to add things to that document, if he can figure out what you're going to add, he may still be able to do this. So one of the ways that you could do this, for example, is this letter that says, you know, I owe you $400 could actually have a letterhead on it. It could actually have an image. And I'm sure most of you are aware, if you've ever looked at things like steganography and stuff like that, you can actually change, say, like the upper bits of each one of the pixels of the image and change that. And people will not perceive the different change in the image at all. It gives you a phenomenal amount of bit space to mess with. And so someone could actually start working with the bits up there to bring the document in a line so that they could actually come up with a variant that actually said, you owe me $400 versus I owe you $400. So that kind of thing is doable. With PDFs, it's really interesting in the fact that PDFs actually have conditionals in them. So you can put a conditional in a PDF. Oops.
PostScript.
Ah, is that right?
Yes, very much so.
Thank you very much, sir. Actually, you know, this was something recently that someone mentioned to me. I hadn't heard it before. I hadn't seen the article on it. And I know PostScript, yes, because I've done that myself. Often it has conditionals for, like, if I'm going to a printer that has three drawers or something like that to use this kind of stuff. So I was surprised about that, but thank you. All right, so it's PostScript, okay? I'll actually have to go tell another person who said that he's wrong. So have you been telling people that they're wrong?
Anytime I see something like that, yeah.
Okay. Well, you clearly weren't at the first meeting on hash functions at this conference. Okay. I found an error there myself because one of the guys up there said the 256 SHA-256 didn't have a bigger block, and he was wrong about that. Anyway, so I'm sorry. Pushing this thing's backwards in its buttons. The right-hand button you'd think would be go forward, but it's the left. Okay, so instead of say PDF, say PostScript. A code module for code signing could actually contain strings that wouldn't be executed and so forth. And so you could do it there. And as an example, a document may contain strings whose characters are garbage, or look like garbage. For example, one of the attacks has actually been against a certificate. A guy actually managed to find Well, she did it. He suggested the tack, and she sat down at a table and worked it out. And she created two certificates where the only difference was the public key value, because that's a binary value, so it looked like garbage to you. And so she changed those, and they came to the same hash. Now, that's still not a bad attack, because it's still the same person, it's still the this, it's still that, you know. So it's kind of a different game here. But anyway, so it looks like that you really have to kind of watch about these things. And the IETF already has an activity going on to try to address these protocols that have these problems. So, ways to defend. Start using SHA-256 and be prepared to transition again. And the reason is because there's a study. You remember the AES, the big, huge competition with everybody from all the countries coming in and doing all this good stuff? They've done the exact same thing for hashes. They've had their first workshop March or something. They got another one coming up in March. And so one would really hope that if this problem isn't intractable, that 4 or 5 years we'll actually see something, and based on a totally different technology. Because the really reason we're having all this problem is because all these hash functions really kind of spring out of the mind of one man, and that's Ron Rivas. You know, so SHA is actually just more work on his concepts in MD5, and that's why the problems happen, because it's all essentially the same kind of basic idea. The other approach is to take away that sole control of the document. In the case of certification authorities, this is done by adding unpredictable content, for example, serial number, although in the talk I just gave the previous hour, since we give you a new thing that allows you to talk about a range of serial numbers, you might want to consider what impact that had there if that was necessary. Code signers could actually have a module submitted to them and actually put something in, you know, basically say, please reserve X, I'm going to plug some information in it. Before I sign it, you can't predict it, and make sure you don't execute it. Okay, that would fix that problem. If you're parties who are trying to do a contract, you could basically say, well, all parties can add unpredictable content just prior to the signing ceremony. Okay, doesn't matter what it is, a letterhead, or this or that, or something like that. But something goes, things go into the document, they go in there right before, and no one has time to essentially, you know, do this filing it takes to try to produce another document. If, however, you run into this problem after the fact, which Stephen will talk about some more. You know, this is like being hit by a meteorite. You can basically say it's kind of strange that this happened accidentally and actually produced viable alternatives that actually give you some sort of business advantage. One might suggest that perhaps some fakery was going on here. So that becomes a possibility. Anyway, the lawyers in the room, unfortunately, life isn't as simple as it used to be. You're going to have to work a little harder. So describing the technology harder. I mean, if anybody saw this thing that was in there yesterday, describing this to juries and judges is going to be interesting anyway. And now you're going to have to say, and incidentally, there's this other little problem we should talk about, okay? You do too many of those, people will just say, well, hey, there's nothing here. And legal protocols, like signing. I mean, when I say protocols, I mean, like computer protocols, there are various exchanges and processes and stuff that happen in the legal and business community, and these may have to be amended a bit to do something along this line. But probably the most important thing you could do if you're counsel or anything else, or you have to do with a technical company or business company, you could say, we need to make this move, we need to make it fairly quickly. I, as my lawyer, recommend you do this if you have any dependence on this kind of stuff. And so you need to get out if you're a company, because it's pushing your suppliers and so forth to move to this really quickly. Okay? That's it. Okay.
Now that my wardrobe is complete. Good morning. My name is Steve Tepler, and I'm here to confuse you. Because this was confusing to me about a year ago. And Hoyt and I spent a good number of hours discussing what the implications of this meant. And as a first comment, yes, lawyers will have to work a little harder, but that means we'll be able to generate a little bit more equity. So there is not everything that's lost by this. The hash collision issues have certain applications in the timestamp arena, and certain specific applications and timestamp arena, because timestamp authorities generally, or entities that create timestamps, basically hash hashes. They don't do anything with documents per se. And because of that, it presents interesting implications on document reliability. And when I say document, I mean any kind of data which an entity creates upon which it can be sued. So for simplicity's sake, I'm just going to call it data documents, because when I call them data blobs, people start thinking Rorschach tests. So we have trusted timestamps. Based upon the standards that are out there, there's an Etsy standard as well, basically adopting the same protocols that are in RFC 3161. The client, when you create a timestamp, you will basically take a document, run a hash of the document, take that digest, message digest if you prefer that term, and then you will basically add time and date information to that within some sort of protected boundary or under some sort of protected environment using a trusted time source that can be vetted and can be proved later on, and then send another hash, a hash of a hash, back to the requester for later validation. And basically, you run the process backwards in order to validate the document against the timestamp. And if you maintain an unchanged copy of both the timestamp and the document, you can hopefully forever after, until they crack some sort of next generation type of encryption, be able to validate it and be able to rely on it. It's not identity-based. This is not about somebody signing a document. When you timestamp a document, you are having an entity timestamp and basically say that a document, a data blob, existed either at, or as the people in the tech industry like to say, before a certain instant in time. And I'm going backwards. It's because I like the picture of the lawyer.
Well, it's actually because it's not intuitive, the left button is the one that you go.
Except that, you want to point this one?
Makes a difference.
Wait, no, before you point this one.
You want to hit the left button and go forward.
Left button? No, is this the left button here? This is good.
What did you do?
Oh, wait, left button. That's the button. I see there's three buttons here, and this is left, too. I'm very literal about these things. I see button. This is not a button. This is a... Okay. Anyway, let's go back to the presentation here. All right. Federal Rule of Evidence 901B, the mother of all evidence rules. The requirements to be met basically are pretty simple, seeming. Where the accuracy of results is dependent on the process that produces it, you have to make an inquiry. You have to ask, whether this document, what is the provenance, what is the source of the document, how do we know that it is what it purports to say it is? But we want to know the components of the accuracy of the data, who, what, when, where, why. Very simple. Everybody's done it. If you haven't done it in litigation, you've heard about it on TV. Then you have to conduct an inquiry, for our purposes, into the reliability of the system producing the data. With people, it's not that hard to do. You take testimony. I saw him or her sign that document on less than such day, and we used a pen or a pen, and I saw this piece of paper, and here's a piece of paper, and we can do forensic tests on the paper to determine how old it is or whether the ink was released into commercial production before or after the signature was put on the page. Very simple. Kind of. We're not there yet. Certainly not there yet. Here we go. Standard factors when it comes to electronic process. Computer hardware and software must be accepted in the field as standard and competent. Lawyers have a very big problem because they don't understand the technology. And if they don't understand the technology, how on earth can you make a statement that it is accepted in the field? Well, you get an expert. Well, that's good, but the expert is not necessarily sophisticated in the legal part of the analysis to be able to say that the reliability for legal purposes is what can be counted on. Why? Because just because the blinking light blinks blue does not mean that the goal of the process that is purported to work has been achieved. And that's one of the important things to consider. The equipment must be in good working order. Qualified computer operators were employed. I guess those were in the days of, computer operators. I don't know what a computer operator is anymore. Proper procedures were followed in connection with the input and output of information. This sounds suspiciously like the CPS to me, but I'm not going to go any further into that inquiry. A reliable software program was utilized. Notice the word reliable keeps popping up here. I'm going to go into that in a minute. The equipment was programmed and operated correctly, and the exhibit is properly identified as the output in question. Again, we're talking about provenance. By provenance, I am equating the ways to establish the genuineness of an antique in the antique industry. And the way one does that is to take the antique and you do a physical examination, of course, to see whether or not the shellac or whatever the veneer they use is what they used 200 years ago. But you also look at magazine, which might have shown an exhibit of this very piece in a furniture catalog from the turn of the century. Or you might have a statement, a will, that somebody had left this particular piece in 1909 to somebody's grandmother. That will establish provenance as well. We have a case that came out 2 years ago in Connecticut. And this case basically hinged upon, it was the first case to address admissibility of computer evidence only. And it was a criminal case and had a lot to do with a lot of other things, including bite marks. But the important thing is that the idea of the indicia of reliability for the admissibility of digital data came to the forefront of the judge's attention. And the issue also was, well, is it computer enhanced or is it computer generated? To my thought, everything is computer generated. Why? Because an enhancement is a generation. But the court, I was satisfied, actually, the court actually addressed the issue of computer generation. Because at least they were now saying, computer generated means it's not generated in the real world. Okay, so there's some sort of understanding that we're going from the real into the electronic. And it was a giant step. It was a large, large, large opinion. Somewhat soon thereafter, there was a case abroad through Barrett and Associates. It was a negligence case. And they distinguished enhanced from generated. And they said, okay, if it's computer generated, we need to have a little bit more because we really don't have a physical thing to attach it to establish provenance. So you have to show more for reliability. Very, very good. We're getting there, but we're not there yet. The latest chink of the reliability argument came in last December, where a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled on a trial judge's exclusion of evidence provided by American Express that was unopposed. Unopposed. It was electronic data about a creditor, about a debtor's charges on American Express. And because American Express had done such a poor job of showing how it generated these electronic charges, the judge, sua sponte, said, I'm not going to allow it into evidence. And he said, wait a minute, we have our computer guy here. He said he did it. And he said, judge said, that's not enough. I don't see any reliability in addition. So here we go, and we say, good. Digital evidence, what technologists aren't trained to know. Bad people can create bad programs or create bad programs to generate bad data. What lawyers aren't trained to know is that how bad people can create bad programs or how to create bad programs to generate bad data. There's a kind of a dysfunction here. And here we are in the dystopia. The guy holds electronic voting machines. Voter auditability, verification auditability. Great. Let's take a printout of the vote. Good. Tell you what, I'm going to change the executable so that when I print it out, it shows vote A. When I audit it, it'll show vote B. And when I go in to check the code, it'll show that nothing's wrong. We can do that. It has been done, I'm sure. Blood alcohol detection scene, penny chloride and toxilizer case. They're asking for source code because there seems to be 17 versions of this approved code around, but there's only been one set of code that was sent to the state for approval. So they're saying, look, unless we see the source code, how do we know that this device worked correctly and is about to strip people of civil rights, take away the right to drive, give them criminal records? Well, maybe. What's the four? I see what you mean. All right. Sweeten Beef State again. The this is loud. Am I going back? No, I'm going right. This is the right. No, this is left. I swear. It was a good presentation.
It's not that good. Why are you going backwards?
Left. No? Do these buttons reverse?
Try right.
I'm going to try right. Are we going forward or backwards?
Back.
Can I just use the space bar on the left?
Why are you doing this?
Use the keyboard. I'm going to use paper. I don't know.
All right. Shocking news from China. Yes, but it's a quarter a tap.
Okay. Okay, so what's the stuff got to do with hash collisions? Okay, quickly, easily, two data blobs resolve into the same timestamp hash. The problem is that two data blobs can now be offered into evidence. And the problem is that both are real and have valid timestamps, not valid timestamps, because arguably the timestamp is one. So my apologies for that. But only one can be true. Okay, let's talk about what truth is here. Okay, this gets worse. Okay, let's take a sidestep and say, okay, this happened. This could have happened in what happened with Parmalat, where data was time-based data manipulation occurred. Electronic wagers in the Autotoe case, where a $6 million Breeders' Cup ticket was created after the race from a losing ticket by a trusted programmer who basically did some executable rewriting and was able to win himself a ticket to jail. Legal memorandum, Enron Anderson case, we've all heard about that. And in Rite Aid, compensation stock grants letters were redated to give the CFO and the general counsel $30 million in bonuses. This is good. Okay, so now you have two validly timestamped documents, the truly created false document used to carry out the fraud, and the truly created true document. Okay, so we have a true false and a true document. We're following this, right? Okay, there's turbulence ahead. Maybe if I get rid of this, we'll have less. Get out of here.
You're helpless.
I am helpless.
Let the computer guy
do it, right? Meanwhile, back at the court, the indicted executives are invoking FRE 901B and showing the true document that they want to use to get out of jail, right? And say, look, this resolves to the same timestamp. You can't look at me and convict me, man. This don't work. And I don't care about that other document. I have no knowledge of that document. Okay? So what happens? The judge gets confused. What'll he do? He'll throw both of them out. You can't have two pieces of data saying two different things at the same time. Just doesn't happen. You can't be two places at the same time. This is basically saying that. So, here we go. We may have an admissibility problem, or do we? We really don't, okay? Even though the executive may rely on the true document with impunity, can move to dismiss, as all I say, there's a built-in protection here. And this is why the sky isn't falling mostly. You have to create the two data blobs simultaneously. You have to have control over the data-generating environment created on the same machine, and it has to have the same source, which means that if you're going to say, this is the real one and that one's fake, you're pointing the finger at you because you're the only one who could have done it, either you or your agent. Doesn't matter. So really, the two disparate data blobs used in the process are, well, let's look at it this way. The likelihood that two nearly identical data blobs can be used in a hash collision resolved to the same hash are so statistically improbable that I would say it approaches the probability of the monkeys typing away for a long time and coming out with the complete works of Shakespeare. Because the Chinese researchers used two disparate data blobs. The idea that you can have something which gets you in jail or it keeps you out of jail just coincidentally coming together to create one hash is extremely remote. So the very existence of these two data blobs will make you instantly suspect, either the offerer or the data generator or both. All right, now we have a problem. The problem is this. It's what I'm calling the hidden collision. All right, we have a hypothetical breathalyzer test, a breathalyzer machine. The breathalyzer machine has an EEPROM in it, some code, and it basically reads your breath and comes up with an alcohol number. Two versions of code are produced. You have a straight arrow code, which does what it should do, and you have what Hoyt has suggested I call bent code. And the bent code basically will either come up with a positive every fifth, seventh, ninth read, or it can be remotely controlled to do that, or it'll round it up from like 0.7 to 1.2. Okay, just because. Or maybe it'll do that only once every three. So the municipality makes more money, the sheriff gets more, notches on his belt. Everything is wonderful. Both of them can resolve to the same hash. Why? Because the data generator, the machine creator, can have created both of these code sets at the same time and using this hash collision process. The consequences are that you are now going to be arguing that your client wasn't drunk, but now you're going to have to check the code. Because you don't trust the machine. In Florida, there's a case ongoing right now where the manufacturer of the machine will not give up the machine's code because he says because he's running it on Windows platform, it's using proprietary information. There are 2,000 DUIs holding in suspense right now because of this. Now, the problem is that if you substitute, if you just run a timestamp check of the hash code on the bent code, you won't even have to look at the code, and you'll say, hey, this is the code that the state approved, because if you look at the hash code of the approved code and the hash of the code that was in this machine, they're the same. This is a timestamp. The document content is identical. Well, guess what? With a forced hash collision, it won't be. All right, and you won't know it. They both appear to be the deriving from the approved version, and basically you revoke the guy's license and send him off to jail. All right. The problem is that you can then even say, okay, let's check, let's do a code check in, and if you're smart, you'll just remove the bent code EEPROM and substitute the good code EEPROM, and then when the auditor comes to check, he'll say, look, this is what created that output. And no controls. And what this says we need is more policy, more control over what we're doing to make the process more transparent. And perhaps we need to, you know, understand that just because it comes out of the machine doesn't mean we must trust it or presumptively trust it, which is the way that breathalyzer machines work. But the comfort is that it'll take a great degree of sophistication to carry out the fraud. You need a whole lot of big iron to carry it out at the moment. But we should be aware as lawyers that we shouldn't trust it just because somebody says it is what it is, and that without more, we just won't know. And that's it. And I think we're just about ready for questions.
Hi. I'm a little bit confused by this because you're saying to me that the breathalyzer thing that was modified, I was under the impression that to create the same hash code from just changing a couple bits to get this one that rounded up, which wouldn't be significant, would be extremely difficult to have them produce the same hash.
No. I mean, an example I gave is that you actually, with code, have a tremendous amount of flexibility in changing the pattern, yet still having the code work well. By that, I mean you just basically take some buffer areas or something like this, scratch areas, whatever you want to call them, and you just have random-looking strings in there. You ensure that they're not that they're not involved with the code process itself. You can do this cleverly enough that someone won't even necessarily spot it without careful study, and that's the area in which you can change. So I can actually then produce code that really only very slightly in the instructions that it does, for instance, like where I choose to round or something like that. But yet I have that flexibility in terms of this these areas where I can actually just change the data. It's just bits. I can do any kind of changing I want, and it won't affect the execution.
Actually, I think Jerry may have kind of taken my question. My question really goes to the creation of two documents or two separate files that hash to the using the same, the hash function, create the same hash. I mean, wouldn't it be the case that kind of collision is much more likely let's say we're talking about a contract. When you're talking about a contract, it's much more likely that the other document that gives the same hash is actually, say, a recipe for banana bread as opposed to a document that's slightly changed from you owe me to I owe you, something like that.
That last year Witt used the term euphonious, you know, which I thought was a great choice. But here's the question. I asked Ron Rivas and I asked Shamir. They were sitting there together, and I had a chance to chat with them. And I said, do you consider it feasible that I could design a document with a letterhead and that by manipulating bits in the letterhead allow me to create two documents that have useful, viable alternatives, for example, the IOUs that I mentioned? And their answer was yes. I mean, clearly we're in a theoretical nature here, but look at the certificates, two certificates that were the same. And so the trick is, as you've just said, how do I know it's going to be useful? The more simple a document it is, the more difficult it is to create two useful variants. But if the document is really complex, and has all kinds of hidden areas where you can change things at will, and the consumer will never notice things have been changed, bits in the images and so forth, or as the gentleman pointed out to me, PostScript versus PDFs, then in fact you have essentially the elbow room to make the changes to do useful variants. And Steve, you were going to say something.
Yeah, there's also a policy issue that kind of surrounds all this. If I'm going to force a collision on an executable, that's different in that you don't have contraparties in an executable. The executable just does what it says, what it's designed to do. So the idea of saying, how do I know that this wasn't created, with something else at the same time using a forced collision process can't be known. And that's why I call it the hidden collision, because this is something which, if done in a fraudulent fashion, won't be exposed unless somebody fesses up.
Yeah.
Let me just address that point. On the code question, if it ever came to a dispute about whether there is bent code, wouldn't somebody be doing a line-by-line analysis of that code as opposed to just relying on the hashes of the two code sets?
I would hope nowadays, in fact, that they would because of this. But, in fact, since we have this concept of signed code, and since we know that if you compute a hash, it's equal to the other, and, in fact, I would imagine most people, particularly when they're dealing with executables, binaries, not sources, because binaries are the point here. And believe me, having long, long ago had to read binaries line by line by line, it's not quite as easy as you think. And so the attractiveness there is the fact that I can do an arithmetic manipulation of it and depend on it. And the old manipulation isn't perhaps as we can be as confident as we used to be.
And if we're looking for timestamps to vet up code to authenticate code or content rather than identity, this is the threat to the timestamping schema that has to be addressed.
Some good news, some bad news. Start off with a bad news. Yesterday, the cryptography group identified that the SHA-256 algorithm may also be susceptible to the same sort of collisions that we see with SHA-1. They just say it's a matter of time before the same collisions are going to appear. But the good news is the same group said and pointed out there are some very simple things that you can do to the message that completely protect it against the collisions.
Yeah.
Padding the message with selective pieces of information, spaces, zeros.
Unpredicted content. That was said in my slide.
Right, yeah. Right. Maybe the simple solution here is when you go to produce a document, add a lot of boilerplate stuff that can be visually validated and check that and the digital signature at the same time.
For example, in the signing ceremony, it might be reasonable that all three parties agree that they're going to stick their letterheads up at the front, and they actually do minute and they make their letterheads unpredictable because there's always some sort of slight changes happening in the images. Then that would do it. Yeah, that's correct. And incidentally, you may also note that when I said go to 256 and prepare to transition again. The idea here is that's just giving you some more breathing room. It's just more work. I mean, all that was said was that most of the work of this attack is against the first block. That's where you have to apply it. You increase the size of that block and we'll go. But fundamentally, it's still its ancestors are MD5 and MD4 and so forth to go. So what we're really looking for, like the cryptographer said, something with new DNA, mm-hmm. Okay, that's totally different. And that's the real answer.
Right.
So.
Hey, just a last comment. I want to echo Steve's point that if you do get two documents that hash to the same value, and it's part of the question, I totally agree. The conspiracy is on the one individual.
There's no way you can escape it. If you can show that there's such a statistical improbability, computationally infeasible, of this event happening where two nearly identical documents just happen to form the same, result in the same hash. You're actually pointing a finger at yourself, presumptively.
Yeah,
and that's what I would argue.
But the major problem I see with this is we're trying to create an environment where this technology becomes understood and you don't have to explain it. when someone says, I called my broker, you don't spend a lot of time explaining how the telephone system really did deliver your phone call to the broker. However, voice over IP, we may be forced to be able to do that again. So we really wanted to get to the point where we wouldn't have to do this. And what this does is it actually confuses the issue. So I have to point out, well, there is this possibility. But if it does, Your Honor, then it really means that, you know, this is like being hit with a meteorite. And what's the odds of that? And if the Your Honor happens to be a guy who says, well, you know, I knew a guy whose dog was hit by a meteorite, you're screwed. Okay? So I'd like not to go there. Yes?
Focusing on the statistical improbability of finding two matches really quickly. I thought that the other day somebody said that it was that the probability of being able to find a statistical match dropped to like 1 in 260 or 26 million or something. Is that about right? From something else to 1 in 26 million or
because
something?
Because the bits, yeah. She's actually got another 1.5 bit increase in her production. So
But that's not the analysis of the creation of the documents or the documents themselves that created the hash, okay?
I guess what I'm getting at, though, is if I can... So I have to create two documents, and I have to put in enough random garbage in an image or if I'm doing source code in some sort of binary somewhere that's never going to get executed or something. In order to do that, wouldn't I have to basically have, like, if I take that number, wouldn't I have to have on the order of 33 megabytes
information
to play around with to do that?
No, you're just introducing just a, all your you've misunderstood. You seem to say we're talking about introducing random additional randomness or something like that. All we're doing to do is initiate unpredictable values. What you're really trying to do is to stop that person from saying, I know that this guy issues certificate serial numbers, bumping them by one or two or three. So I'm just sit there and work and figure that that's what the values are going to be. And if the guy instead appends four digits or five digits, you know, they'll argue for more or something like that just for flexibility.
That's not where I'm going.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm misunderstanding then. No, in fact, it's been proven that's not true. I mean, I don't know what I need to do the math, but we can show you it's not true. It's what's been done. Yeah.
For the hacker, the problem that the timestamps solve is if you want to manipulate the bit in the header, in the header of the letter, you are forced, as part of the attack, to maybe manipulate another bit somewhere else on that letter. And it might be a timestamp, it might be something else. So when we talk about adding additional information, what we're doing is we're putting pieces of information in the document that we know the hacker can't change for many different things. And that makes it much more difficult to change one bit through this and get this into a signature.
The analysis of the ITF, for instance, is just basically saying you could really handle some of the attack against a potential against a certificate just by going to some more precision on the timestamp in terms of clock and picking up some more numbers on the seconds and stuff like that. So that's, you know, I have to go with their concept of practice. To tell you the truth, I know people who directly know people who've gone to work with a lady in China. I mean, I was just astounded to find out that she didn't really use a computer, that she actually sat down at a large table and kind of just mentally went through this process to do this. This is a phenomenal concept to me, you know, that she actually did this. So I honestly can only – not being a mathematician and as I said, being in all of hash functions anyway – the only thing I really know about it is that there's a significant amount of work in the first block, and then you will have to change a couple of bits and so forth, possibly in the second block, and then you've done the job. So right now, until we go into entirely new DNA for a hash function, only the block size is going to help. Yes, we have another question, and we have a stop. Yeah, if we can do it at the back.
All right. Thanks a lot. We appreciate it.